back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, after rejecting a ceasefire agreement, Israel increased its bombing of the southern Gaza city of Rafah Monday night. In the small hours Tuesday, the eastern section of the border town was leafleted, then heavily bombed, while the crossing with Egypt, the only avenue of escape, was seized, with 20 people there reportedly being executed. Whether or not this bodes the long-promised ground invasion of the city, where more than 1.5 million Palestinian civilians have fled over the course of the now 7 months-long genocide campaign, is difficult to determine. Bombing civilians is one thing, but facing the waiting soldiers of Gaza's resistance is quite another. Laith Marouf is the Palestinian-Canadian founder of FreePalestine.video. The longtime multimedia consultant and producer is currently chronicling the Palestine disaster from his base in Beirut. Free Palestine Video says it's meant to fill a large gap and provide coverage, quote, in the absence of media supporting the resistance forces in the English language due to the ban in the West. Laith Marouf and the next stage in an epochal struggle for the future playing out today in Palestine. Welcome back to the program, Laith.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always great to be with you.
It's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Laith, since we spoke last month, the absence of media in Palestine, as described, has been catastrophically exacerbated with the violent removal of Al Jazeera Monday past from Palestine and Israel. Is the timing of that expulsion, Laith, significant?
I definitely was timed with the decision for the Zionists to invade the Rafah region of the Gaza concentration camp. So given that Al Jazeera English specifically has been the only Western oriented media outlet, television station that is covering what's happening in Palestine, it definitely shows that it's a significant move and that the Israelis want to cut the last avenue of information available for Western audiences speaking English.
Well, and of course, Al Jazeera was taken off the cable I think it's been taken off in Britain, but it was done here and in the United States as well years ago now. I mean, you could still get it like on the computer online, but this kind of censorship is not unique to Israel by any means, especially where Al Jazeera is concerned.
Yeah, definitely. Also, that shows, given that Al Jazeera is controlled by a vassal state, Qatar, mm-hmm. and it's run by a Canadian, or at least when it started, it was the CBC X manager that was running Al Jazeera English. So even though that this is part of the what we would call Western propaganda machine, it still is being slapped left and right whenever it crosses a line that is drawn by the masters in Washington, D.C. And clearly, if you watch the difference between the coverage in English and in Arabic of Al Jazeera, you'll see the lines that are drawn for Al Jazeera to dance around in English. And of course, in general, even in the Arabic content, Al Jazeera always tries to undermine the axis of resistance, Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, Syria, who are the only ones that are really supporting the Palestinians in their struggle for liberation. So even in the Arabic content, Al Jazeera plays a role that is allowed to it by the empire, which is to give, to undermine in any way possible, even if that includes showing you what's happening on the ground in Gaza, but to undermine the axis of resistance that is empowering the Palestinians to liberate themselves.
But even that service to empire, as you describe, doesn't grant their reporters in the field immunity. We've seen them beaten up and roughed up and even shot dead by Israeli forces.
Yes, like, Shireen Abu Akleh, the Palestinian-American journalist that was killed last year, or 2 years ago now. So, sometimes you see even Al Jazeera reporters being offered as a sacrifice, as we saw on the altar of Zionism, to scare the other reporters. And we've seen also Al Jazeera being targeted, of course, in Afghanistan and in Iraq, by the American military, and even though, again, it plays a role. And this is those unfortunate journalists that work for Al Jazeera are cheap fodder for even the owners of Al Jazeera, the Qatari government.
Yeah, I wonder how many people remember the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad shelled by an American tank, very precisely killing three, if I remember rightly, Al Jazeera reporters.
You are right. And of course, the United States targeted Al Jazeera offices in Kabul during the war in Afghanistan. So we see this kind of role that Al Jazeera plays, on the one hand, appearing as if it's a critical outlet against American hegemony, on the other, constantly undermining anyone that actually fights that hegemony, and finally, to provide these occasional sacrifices on the altar of Zionism to scare the journalists in general, because of the, you know, as we see journalists from Al Jazeera being targeted, get 100, if not 1,000 times more coverage than regular journalists in the region. And you can see that in the coverage of the more than 150 now journalists killed in Gaza, and how much more attention Al Jazeera reporters got because of their outlet being such a loyal imperial tool.
Well, and of course, here we really want to believe, I think, as viewers, that there is a media white knight that we can believe and that is doing the good fight. But, and maybe there is somewhere, but it's not Al Jazeera necessarily, but they are doing an important work. As far as the roughly, I think, estimated 150 Palestinian journalists killed in Gaza during this current what we come to recognize as being a deliberate genocidal campaign by Israel, they were recognized sort of at the Pulitzer Awards just this past week, but they still remain anonymous.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I mean, it was a very funny, funny in a psychotic way, the Pulitzer Prize and the, what is it called, the foreign journalist, or the dinner that the president has with the journalist, I forget his name, in United States, and the and the equivalent of it in Canada, the politics and the pen. So all of these awards that we saw in the last few weeks, on the one hand, were given awards to Zionist reporters in places like the Washington Post and the New York Times that have been crucial in disseminating the Zionist propaganda in the West and the lies about what happened on October 7th. And on the other, we see this, you know, symbolic unnamed awards to the blob of Palestinian and Arab journalists that, you know, cannot be made to be humanized more than that. And at the Pen and the Politics and the Pen Awards in Canada, or the gala, we saw how they treated anyone that spoke about Palestine or defended
ejection.
Yes.
Yeah, one recipient being invited to leave the premises and escorted from the stage and cleaned right out the door.
Yep, yep. And so in reality, you know, right now this war in Gaza is ending the illusion that anyone still had about freedom of the press or independence of the media in the West. You know, and these 7 months of genocide showed how the vast majority, if not all, licensed broadcasters in Canada and the United States are all tools of the state and will line to parrot the positions of the government, even if it means the stripping of their own rights as journalists.
Well, and before getting to the parrots in this country, Canada, where you resided and still hold citizenship, just on the Pulitzers, the grand awardee this year for the best foreign journalism was given to the New York Times, and as an extra finger in the eye to truth and any notion of journalistic integrity, it was made clear that that was for its coverage of Gaza.
Yes, yes. So there's no more pretense even of pretending. You know, things are right in the open. It's the same way as we see how the police are being ordered by political figures to suppress the students and so on. So there's no more even this illusion that there is a separation between how the police behave in the streets or conduct themselves in their pursuit of applying laws. So we see now direct political orders to the police. We see direct lines of power in the media all exposed, and nobody is ashamed of it. Now everything is out in the open because it's a desperate time for the elites in Canada, in the United States, in the West, because they have lost the support of the vast majority of the populations. And it seems right now they don't care anymore. They don't need to pretend, and they are using full force of exclusion, of targeting, of expulsions, destroying people's careers, taking them to jail, charging them with fake charges. This is now a full repression descending in the West. And sitting here from Lebanon, I tell you, it seems like people here in Lebanon have 100 times more freedoms than somebody in Canada.
Well, and the worry is, of course, that the story of the demonstrations against the Gaza genocide start to overtake the story of the genocide itself. And there seems to be, whether it's by design or just the natural progression of the way the media works, that the campus resistance stories that have spread from the United States into Canada and Europe and other places, too, I expect, is competing now with the actual origin story of the genocide.
Well, I would disagree with that assessment for one reason, because the media in the West, specifically in the last 3 months, have practically blocked out the story of the genocide. You know, you would open CBC and do the almost a story about a cat stuck on a tree on their front page, almost, you know, making jokes. But this is really how it was for the last 3 months. So I would disagree, because I think the actions of the students have now forced the media in the West to readdress the story. And because it's so close to home, there's no way for the Iron Curtain that was being descended on the genocide in Gaza over in the media in the West to actually work. Things were boiling out in the streets. And I actually encourage the students in the West to continue their activities, to continue their militancy, to and take as much space as they want to. As we get closer to election days in the United States and election days in Canada and the United Kingdom, these are now, it's crucial to make the issue of Palestine and the liberation of Palestine into a domestic issue. So you see, there's that understanding. I know how some people were in Palestine or in other places were worried about this issue of the student movement overtaking the space for Palestine and Western media. But I am in disagreement with that analysis because of the fact that the media coverage of Gaza, even when it was at its height in the West, was very negative to the Palestinian people. And that didn't even matter in the equation of reaching the masses in the West. Social media and the Palestinian community's activities on social media is the one that got the Western audience to get educated on the issue. So if the Western mass media is now beholden by the student movement, that's great. That's another space that is being conquered now.
The adroitness with which some of the students handle the press, that it's evident when they're trying to be goaded into the anti-Semitism debate and the whole long history of everything else. And encouraging too, and the ones I've seen have been very good at bringing the point back around to the point of their first place. When you talk about the CBC and the cats and tree stories this morning, I listened to the CBC radio, and at this on this day when so much is going on, especially around what's happening in Rafah that we can get to in a second. But their lead story was a reversal in the courts allowing gay and bisexual men to donate their sperm that had been prohibited because of their sexual practices, partly, which was the issue that the story went on to say, well, we've come a long way with this, but there's still further to go because it's certain sexual practices were part of this prohibition that now is on its way to being released. That was a 5-minute lead-in to the top of the hour news on CBC National Radio this morning.
Wow. I mean, look, the Western elite have for decades now made the issue of what individuals want to do with their genitalia and or what they want others to do with this genitalia that they have between their legs into a national debate, when in reality, being straight, gay, or how you like to describe yourself, or how you'd like to behave in bed, or how you like love in your life to be, are a personal issue. This is not to be something to be debated in the public, you know, and this is the way we look at it in the South and the East. Of course, everybody should have their freedoms, but again, the freedom is for you to discuss with, you know, in private, what you do with your privates. But this purposeful obsession with genitalia and what we do with it is a, you know, a programmed distraction that has definitely worked. And the way that you see these issues constantly overtaking the public space of debate, and while, of course, recognizing that the communities that identify in different ways are targeted and have some of their rights not fully granted, that doesn't mean that this should be the number one issue. All these issues could be, of course, solved by taking the state out of this debate and returning it to the privacy of the individual.
Well, and for the for those gay and bisexual couples that want to have children, and that, I mean, by all means, I'm sure there's a way that this could be arranged and that it's an important story to you. But 5 minutes on the lead of the national news, I don't know if it really deserves that. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Laith Maarouf. Laith is a Palestinian-Canadian and founder of FreePalestine.video. The longtime multimedia consultant and producer is currently chronicling the Palestine disaster from his base in Beirut. When we talk about media, Laith, it's not just the CBC and the New York Times and the rest. We can jump to conclusions and be manipulated by disinformation quite innocently, and maybe sometimes not so much so. When we talked about the fear campaign that is designed to scare different people, but that we can echo those messages. I'm thinking specifically here of Pepe Escobar's reportage during the Iran-Israel back and forth rocket fire, and his fantastical story about a nuclear plot by Israel, etc. But there's other stories less fantastic, but we are being manipulated. One of the things that we talked about was whether the Rafah land invasion was just another one of these information operations designed to panic the people in Rafah. What's going on there right now, this moment?
Well, at this moment, the Israelis occupied the Rafah crossing, which is at the southern eastern edge of Rafah city. So they haven't entered Rafah city, but they are constantly bombarding the edges of the city and using what got now colloquially named fire belts of lines of fire of from the air, ground, and sea that you know, move further and further in. So and also the Israelis attacked and occupied the last remaining major hospital in the south of Gaza in the, on the outskirts of Rafah city. So we see them continuing in this kind of, you know, skirmish situation. They haven't dared yet enter the city. For myself, I'm not sure yet. Look, I've said this throughout this war. The Israelis are stuck in a quagmire, and behind them, the Americans too. There's no choice, only two choices in front of them. One is to accept defeat and have a full exchange of prisoners of war. The other is to go into a full genocidal zero-sum war. And throughout this war and the moving of escalation ladder, the Israelis will still have those choices in front of them. So today, we could be seeing the last 72 hours of Israeli massacres. The Israelis usually, at the end of any confrontation that we've seen over the last 20 somewhat years, take the last 72 hours to commit as many massacres as possible before a ceasefire comes into effect. That could be one possibility. The other possibility, of course, is that we will be going into a wider battle, and that the United States either does not want Israel to stop right now or doesn't have the ability to stop Netanyahu and his cabal from continuing on this path.
Well, a couple of days ago, we were hearing, at least I was hearing, as I watch Al Jazeera online, I don't know what the CBC was saying about it, but that Hamas had agreed to a ceasefire that had been negotiated. Israel said, well, I don't know who you're talking to. It's not us. What's the story on the ceasefire, not ceasefire?
Well, the ceasefire proposal was put forward by the Turks, the Qataris, the Egyptians, and the Americans, basically on behalf of Israel. And Hamas accepted it, and suddenly Israel said it doesn't accept it, and the Americans pretended as if they didn't already have the Israeli approval on this ceasefire. And now Burns, the head of the CIA, is in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and he's trying supposedly to work out a new detail in this proposal. If the Israelis come back with something less than a complete ceasefire and an end to hostilities, clearly the resistance will not accept it. So I'm not sure what changes Burns is proposing, but if they change this basic fact of a complete end to hostilities, which Ben-Gvir and Smoltrich and Netanyahu have been refusing, then there's nothing to talk about, and we will see ourselves in a wider war that includes the non-state components of the axis of resistance. And as we've seen for the last 24 hours, the border between Lebanon and Palestine is at it's the highest intensity of battles, with close to 120 missiles and drones fired from Lebanon on the North Palestine region and hitting the main bases in both the occupied Golan Heights and the Galilee.
We're not getting much, as little genuine media as we're getting here on what's going on in Gaza. We're getting even less on what's going on the northern border and the Hezbollah front from Lebanon, where you are now. It seems that it has stepped up. There was the attack, as you mentioned, on the Golan and in Galilee. Can you provide any more? What is the mood within Lebanon right now? Does it seem that to the people on the street, or do they feel that they're in a full scale war, or how is this? What's the atmosphere there now?
Well, obviously, being in Beirut or away from the border on the south and or the Bekaa Valley, you don't feel that you're at war. We are at the threshold of a full-scale war, but the battlefield has been kind of defined in the south and in the Bekaa Valley for most of these 7 months. Now, everybody here in Lebanon, as well as the whole region, are holding their breath for the next
24 to 72 hours to see what happens, because it's clear if there is no ceasefire, we will be moving to the next stage of war, and this will include a full-out war between Hezbollah and the Zionists, and it will include the participation of Ansarullah in Yemen and the Iraqi and Syrian resistance forces. And this is going to be a war that, if we say Gaza is a war that we haven't seen since World War II, what we will see with this all-out war between the Zionist colony and the Axis of Resistance is something that could drag us quickly into a world war.
Well, yeah, I was watching you speaking just the other day online at Activist News Network with their host, their excellent host, Ryan Napoli, or Napoli, rather. And you were talking about the stages of what we're seeing here and saying that we're heading into stage two of this conflict. Can you flesh that out and describe what you mean by stage two, or maybe let us know what stage one was, and then where we're at now in your view?
Yeah, so stage one was the direct conflict between the resistance forces inside Gaza, inside historical Palestine, with the Zionist colony. And with only minimal, although it, of course, is very huge, but only minimal participation of other parts of the Axis of Resistance in this war. Stage two is the involvement of the non-state actors within the Axis of Resistance in a direct confrontation with Israel to save off a full Holocaust in Gaza, and to save the resistance in Gaza from total defeat. So this is where we are now at the edge of. If there's a threat of defeat to the Palestinian resistance inside Gaza, and or a full-out genocide, more like 10 times what we are seeing, of course, is what it would cause. An invasion of Rafah will cause mass deaths faster than we've seen already in the 7 months, that will trigger this stage. Stage three, and I'm saying this for everybody to hear, because if Hezbollah goes into Palestine, the Israeli military will be defeated, the ground forces, very fast. Most of northern Palestine will be liberated very fast. And those American forces that are waiting in Cyprus and have built that pier in the water, supposedly to bring aid to Gaza, will be using that pier to save the collapse of the Israeli military by invading Palestine to face off with Hezbollah and the other resistance groups that will be supporting it on the ground. So once that happens and the United States enters this battle, we will see ourselves in stage three, which will include the entrance of Iran into this battle, and then who knows what will happen next. Things will be unpredictable by that point. But at this moment, and I think this is what the Americans are trying to do for a while now, they're trying to make the Israelis understand that they cannot even withstand stage two, let alone stage three of this war. But as we all know, a cessation of hostilities right now, if there's a ceasefire right now, it means a internal battle inside the Zionist colony and maybe an internal battle inside the United States. This is why I think Biden and his regime, although they criticize Netanyahu openly or try to pressure him to bite the pill, they are still not fully convinced that they can survive the political outcome of an end of hostilities in Gaza.
Yeah, and there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Israelis that want Netanyahu out. And he's a known, especially within Israel, he's a known criminal and facing charges the minute he's doesn't have the protection of the office once he's out of power, another reason he stays in power. And, of course, Biden, too, is embroiled in criminality that